possibly even within a year, using this approach. So it's an alternate approach, and hopefully we'll have a similar successful outcome. And here in Edinburgh, Thilo Kunath, whom I visited earlier today, is also doing some pioneering work with this sort of cell source for cell replacement and to model disease, because you can take them from the patients and look at these cells and see if they behave in a different way than if they're taken from someone who doesn't have a disease. Now, science sometimes goes in directions that you can never predict. And I must say, this whole idea that this is possible, if you'd asked me 15 years ago, I'd say, nah, it's never going to work. I mean, you could imagine that you could try, but it's never going to work. But the next step, which was shown just a few years ago now, some 5 years ago, is even more remarkable. What has been shown recently is that you can take the skin fibroblasts here and you can reprogram them so they become dopamine neurons directly. So these are called induced neurons. So they don't even go via the stem cell step. So just think about this. The cells that are in your skin can be taken into a culture dish, and with a bit of genetic engineering, a couple of weeks later, they can be nerve cells. Precise nerve cells that are needed for transplantation therapy in Parkinson's disease. And the advantage with doing this approach, although this is not close to a clinical application, this particular approach, but the advantages in the future might be that we will never have any risk of tumor growth, because these cells are not stem cells. So here there is a tiny risk of tumor growth that we have to avoid, but there will be no risk of tumors. And the disadvantage would be that we need to grow a lot of skin cells. So you have to harvest a lot and grow a lot of these. But isn't this exciting? It's quite a remarkable development. And for me, it's been exciting to be part of this journey, remembering the early 80s when we struggled with this technology in animals. We did our trials in patients. And to think that today we can get cells exactly the type we want from the laboratory without using fetal material or embryonic material as starting material. Now, another approach to repair the brain, as I said, is gene therapy. So putting in new genes in the brain, and I'm just very briefly going to describe to you how one can here restore the chemicals that are missing. So here we're not replacing cells. And one idea is to take a virus that was evolved for some other reason, completely change it in the laboratory, so engineer it, and insert genes into that virus, so the virus now will cause the production of dopamine. So the genes that are inserted into the virus are the genes for enzymes that make dopamine. Then you inject these viruses into the brain, the Parkinson brain, and they will start making dopamine. And this has been published. The first trial with this particular approach, a collaboration between a French group, actually a multi-center group, trial, but a French group leading it together with Oxford Biomedica, and you see Roger Barker's involved here too, your former speaker. And the amazing thing is that although this was geared to look at safety of the approach, so they weren't really looking for an effect of the gene therapy, they are seeing hints of an effect of this gene therapy. So here's some brain imaging of a patient at baseline here, 6 months after the gene therapy, and you can appreciate there's some change in the color between here and here, and to the scientists, this indicates that there's been an upregulation of dopamine production due to that gene therapy. So this is very exciting, but very early days. And gene therapy is a flexible approach, so there are many growth factors that can protect brain cells that can also be delivered using gene therapy, and there are trials in the United States with such a growth factor called GDNF, which is also being injected in Bristol through a pump. So there are many ways to use modern technology to repair the brain. Now, I hope this excites you and gives you a feel of optimism, and now I'm sort of going to take you back down to Earth again, ironically with a slide showing the moon. The best drug for Parkinson's disease is still L-DOPA, and it said it was discovered in 1967. That's not entirely true. It was actually discovered in Lund, my old university town in the late 50s by Arvid Carlson, but it didn't really come into clinical practice in a useful manner until around 1967. But the sobering thing is that L-DOPA is still the best drug. This is a very long time. So what's the problem? How have we managed to cure Parkinson's disease in hundreds of different animal models in hundreds of different ways in animal models, and yet none of this has translated into successful clinical trials? So I think it's important to say we might not have been using the right experimental models. And what do I mean by this? Well, for us to be able to create new drugs that are effective in patients, we must make sure that the animals we're testing them in truly reflect the disease process or really represent the brain in Parkinson's disease. So really the key to success is understanding the molecular mechanisms that underlie Parkinson's disease. Do we know what these are? Not entirely, but we know a lot more than we did 20 years ago. 20 years ago, we didn't even know that there are genes that can cause Parkinson's disease, specific mutations. Today, we know that 5% or possibly even up to 10% of Parkinson's disease is inherited. The remaining 90%, on the other hand, we don't really know what causes the disease in the remaining 90% of the patients. And there are some favorite theories that I think are pretty strong by now, and we built very strong cases as a research community for at least three different ideas. One is that there is a failure of the energy production in cells. In the nerve cells that die, the energy powerhouses stop working properly. The second one is that the cells in the brain can't handle certain proteins appropriately, and therefore those proteins will clump together and form these large aggregates that are called Lewy bodies. And the third theory, which is an interesting sort of simple theory, and I think you'll appreciate this when I describe it, is that perhaps inflammation is a driver in the Parkinson's disease process, because we know inflammation occurs in the Parkinson brain. So I'm going to describe each one of these very briefly in very simple terms and give you a flavor for how we think we can then devise new therapies based on this knowledge. Why do we think cellular energy deficits occur in Parkinson's? Well, it's been possible to study gene expression patterns in Parkinson patients in various tissues, and they all show that there seems to be a shortage of energy. There's something wrong with the energy powerhouses called mitochondria. So these large factories that make the energy is failing. And we also know that some of the rare mutations that occur are clearly linked to mitochondria. So that gives us a hint that if you have a mutation that disrupts this organelle in the cell, then you can get Parkinson's disease. We also know that if you take a toxin that affects mitochondria, inject it into the brain, the cells that are susceptible in Parkinson's are also very susceptible to those toxins. And finally, we know that there is evidence for free radical stress in Parkinson's disease brains. And free radical stress is a byproduct of mitochondrial failure. So all of this put together suggests that there could be a problem in energy production. Now, why would the dopamine neurons die and not everything in the body die if there is a fundamental failure of energy production? Well, one thought is that the dopamine neurons are particularly susceptible to energy failure. And that is because they're very long. So Paul Bolam in Oxford has estimated that the length of the arms, the axons that the dopamine neurons have, can be up to 4 meters, which is more than 4 yards. A lot of feet. Very long, from this end of the table. 2/3 of the way along that. And imagine that's all wrapped up in your head, because each cell branches repeatedly, and the cell body's tiny, tiny, and it has a few mitochondria that has to supply all the energy to keep this cell alive. And that might be one reason they're so susceptible. And I will get back to this concept when I describe some emerging therapeutic developments. Now, the second idea is that there's a mishandling of proteins. And you've already seen the Lewy body. We now know what the Lewy body is made up of. We didn't know that 20 years ago. We just knew it existed. It was described in 1912, but it wasn't until 1998 that we really fully understood what the Lewy body was made up of. And it's a protein called alpha-synuclein that is the main constituent of this. And this protein misfolds and forms a Lewy body. It's basically an insoluble aggregate. It just will not go into solution. It's stuck in the cell. And what we've learned, and Professor Chandran referred to this, is that not are these Lewy bodies just sitting there in a cell quietly like this and the misfolded synuclein staying in one cell, but we're understanding that this stuff can move from one cell to another. And that was the strange and serendipitous discovery we made in some of the transplanted patients. So when they had passed away, through natural causes, 10 to 15 years after the surgery, we looked at their transplants, and we saw that inside the transplanted cells, there were Lewy bodies. And we thought maybe the Lewy bodies had jumped from the sick brain to the healthy transplanted cells like this. And this has led to an explosion of interest in the last 6 years, and lots of groups are pursuing this now. And we're able to model this in cell culture dishes. So we can see that if you have an affected cell in the Parkinson brain where you have a misfolded alpha-synuclein, a bad guy, that bad guy can then get outside the cell. This is really surprising. Nobody would have guessed this 10 years ago. Gets outside the cell. And then when it's outside the cell, it can be gobbled up by a neighboring healthy cell, gets inside there, and this is where the magic happens. The healthy-shaped alpha-synuclein, which is in the healthy cell, it has what we call a natively unfolded structure, so it doesn't really have any particular shape. When that gets close to the misfolded alpha-synuclein, this bad guy here, it will template onto it and change its shape. So there's a chemical reaction when these two molecules meet, and that's the beginning of the growth of a Lewy body. So the protein now has a sick shape, and the disease has moved from this cell to this cell. So we change the color. And this means that we can possibly now target these bad proteins in a way that we could certainly not do before 1998, because we didn't even know what this protein was. And we certainly weren't thinking the same way before 2008, when we learned that the protein takes this little ride outside the cell. Now we understand that it's accessible to therapeutic intervention in various ways. And one idea is that perhaps we can block the export of the protein through some pharmacological agents that we can discover in the laboratory. Another idea is that we can block the uptake of the protein. The bad guy can sit around outside the cell where it won't do, hopefully, too much harm. Or we can perhaps prevent the seeding event so these two guys never meet. We somehow put something on top of this bad guy once it's inside the cell so it can't affect the nicely unfolded protein. Or we can promote the degradation of this stuff that's now outside the cell. And this idea of promoting degradation is particularly interesting, and I want to give you some exciting, real, recent news in this area. So the idea, I'll show you now more properly drawn cells to describe this. The idea is to target the stuff that's here in the middle, which is alpha-synuclein. Some of it is in that aggregated, insoluble form. Some of it might be in smaller aggregates that can go in and out of cells easily. But the idea is to target that stuff and transport it and put it next to microglia, which are the defense cells of the brain that then can gobble it up and get rid of it. So the way to do that is to use antibodies, part of the body's defense mechanism. And exciting news is that there are now clinical trials with antibodies against various forms of alpha-synuclein, including these little aggregates that I showed you. There's an Austrian company called Aferius that has been funded by the Fox Foundation and the European Union. They have started a safety trial, and that safety trial actually went well, so they're continuing their development of their immunotherapy. They're injecting antibodies into the patients. And the exciting recent news is that another company called Prothena reported just a few weeks ago at a scientific conference in France that they have now used their version of an antibody, injected into healthy individuals, and have measured in a safety trial a 96% reduction of this alpha-synuclein in the blood. Now, that's the blood, it's not the brain, still early days, but very interesting and very promising. So interesting that I think their stock price went up by like 36% in one day, whatever that means. Now, you might have heard of immunotherapy trials in Alzheimer's disease and that they failed, and so you don't walk away from this meeting thinking, well, it's not going to work because it didn't work in Alzheimer's. I'm going to give you some interesting news there, too. So here are the failed trials in Alzheimer's disease, and they said monoclonal antibodies failed to slow cognitive functional decline in patients with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. This was quite recent, January 2014. But the imaging, the brain camera technology on these patients showed that about a quarter of the patients didn't have the pathology suggesting they didn't have Alzheimer's. They tested this therapy in the wrong type of patient. They had other forms of dementia. And the good news is that also at that meeting in France, Biogen and another one of these companies reported that now they can slow cognitive decline tentatively in a very early trial, not the final ultimate trial, but in an early trial, they're seeing hints that using antibodies in Alzheimer's, if you only take patients who have the amyloid pathology, who really have Alzheimer's, it might work. So I think there's reason to be optimistic with immunotherapy in neurodegenerative disease, not least Parkinson's, where we now know that alpha-synuclein is outside the cells. So what about inflammation? Why do I think inflammation is even worth talking about? It sounds like old stuff that people talked about many years ago. Well, it's still interesting. So what is inflammation in the brain? Well, nerve cells in the brain, they interact with the supporting cells, the glial cells. And there are several types of glia, those that are called astrocytes because they look like stars, those that are called oligodendrocytes that provide the insulating material for the long axons, and finally, the microglia, who are the soldiers of the brain. But normally, microglia don't do much because there isn't much to do in the brain. They're supposed to sit around and watch and see that things don't go wrong because we're not supposed to have infections in the brain. It's supposed to be a quiet, non-inflamed organ. If we have infections, we don't feel well.